Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And as exciting as July was for me, got to play the national anthem at Broncos Stadium with my band, got to open for Candlebox to 1,550 people with my band, which was amazing. Got to talk to my comedy hero, Greg Berendt, which was also amazing. And there were a handful of other things that had happened over the course of the month that I'm just not quite ready to talk about yet. And that's partly because it's not entirely my story to tell. And I think that I'm really going to need to figure out how I'm going to frame all of this before I start having a conversation about it. So I won't tease you anymore about that. Here's what I will say. Today on the show, we have got author, podcaster, and just all-around awesome person, Sean Paul Mahoney. Now, if you're not familiar with this guy, you have got to check out the book, Now That You've Stopped Dying. It's a collection of essays taken from various places, and it's exactly right up your alley if you're into this show, because he's dealing with addiction and recovery, and it's laugh out loud funny. It's really amazing, and the conversation is pretty much the same. So I think you're really going to get into that. The other thing I wanted to talk about is the fact that I've gotten a large influx of people interested in doing the show. And I'm having difficulty getting back to everybody. The other thing that I've noticed about that is that I was always under the impression that, you know, what makes a good podcast guest is their willingness to come on and do it. A good podcast guest is the person who says yes. I think I'm going to need to put an asterisk next to that. Because some of the people that have reached out and said that they're interested in doing the show, they seem like they would be fundamentally opposed to it if they actually took the time to listen to it. One such person is going to be having a conversation with me tonight. And, you know, I think the thing that's interesting about that is that when you start breaking people down into nothing more than a collection of their beliefs, you discount anything else of value and throw it right out the window. And don't get me wrong, I think that there are lines in the sand, you know, where you decide you're not going to have a person in your life. But, you know, they're still human beings at the end of the day, doing the best they can with the information that they've been given. And a lot of times, people have been given pretty bad information, you know, or they've been hurt and they've turned it into an impenetrable armor of anger and fear and whatever. And I think it's important to learn how to listen better. And, you know, that's sort of how we got in this mess, I think. We started dividing ourselves into camps, you know, picking the color of our sports team, go blue, go red, rather than getting behind ideas and saying, you know, I don't think I like that idea. Instead, we're calling out people. And I know there's a lot of nuance to that. It's pretty easy to just say, we're not doing this well. But all I'm saying is, I think it requires us to try a little harder. But somebody I didn't have to try with was Sean Paul Mahoney. So you know what? Let's talk to him.
Writing essays and getting essays published.
Oh, hang on, sorry. It,
yeah,
I apologize.
Sure. No, don't be sorry.
I just realized that something was amiss in the audio.
Okay.
But I got it now.
It happens.
It does.
Yeah, it's part of the deal.
Happy accidents and mistakes.
Right, absolutely.
So let's allow me to start over.
Okay.
And say... good morning again after
good morning.
All of the starts and stops and nonsense.
Okay. Yeah.
But so I just wanted to tell you that I was looking around for people who might be interesting to talk to, and I discovered you online primarily because I found your book. Can you tell me a little bit about your book?
Fantastic. It means whatever I'm doing in my shoddy way of marketing is working. my book is called Now That You've Stopped Dying. It's a collection of essays. I've been writing essays and or blogging. I mean, what's the difference? I really don't know.
Right.
But right. And so I started blogging about my recovery from drugs and alcohol in like 2011, at which point I had 2 years sober. And I started writing because all the books that I read when I got sober in 2009 were all kind of that big dramatic like ending of like, oh my God, they hit bottom and then they got sober and everything was okay.
Yeah.
And that was not my experience. And in a lot of ways, like my life got harder. Yeah. And so my whole blogging started in early recovery blogging and like with a bunch of other people and it was just really a dialogue of like, okay, well, I'm sober now, but life sometimes still sucks and sometimes it's hilarious and a lot of times it's weird. And so I was just writing about that. And then that sort of transpired into getting essays published on places like thefix.com and afterparty.com and Good Men Project. And so that transitioned into this idea of, it was in my mind of doing a book. Meanwhile, I had been podcasting too and also appearing on other podcasts. And so I appeared on my friend Paul's podcast. He hosts a fantastic podcast called Drop the Needle. It's like a music and recovery podcast. Yeah, it's awesome. And I was on an episode and he was like, dude, we all thought you were hilarious. And he runs an independent publishing thing. And he's like, I'd love to help you publish your first book. So that's how that was born. And that was like last summer. And this time last year, I was frantically trying to get my shit together and figure out which essays were going to go in and which new essays I needed to add and all of that stuff. And so then since then, it's just been the process of editing, changing, whatever. And then the version that's out now will not be like the final version too, or we're like a indie publisher. So this is sort of a reader copy that's out now, and then it'll continue to grow. And we'll also have a Kindle version and a audiobook too. So that's that's kind of the thing.
Yeah, I mean that's pretty incredible. That's a side that I think most people don't talk about. A lot of the people that I know who have gone through recovery, they didn't have, they didn't have a lot of those huge romantic problems. You know,
right.
It was just problems.
Yeah, it's just problems. And it's just problems all the time, too. And, you know, I identify with mental health being a large part of my story, too. So that's another spicy added element to the story, you know?
Yeah.
And like that, too, there's no tidy bow with that, too. And I think that's what's frustrating.
Yeah, certainly.
For people who don't understand mental health or addiction, that they think, God, why can't they just do something about it? And why aren't they just better?
Yeah.
Didn't they go to rehab? Isn't everything okay now? And it's like, no, jerk, it's not okay. Like, yeah, it's like a freaking lifelong process.
Yeah.
And so I really wanted to talk to the people who were like myself, who were walking through it every day and doing it with a lot of humor and grace. And so, yeah, that's hopefully what my writing audience is.
Well, take me back a little bit, if we can. What
sure.
was the So what kind of kid were you?
Okay, well, I grew up in an alcoholic home. My name is Sean Paul Mahoney, and my last name, I mean, the whole name is very Irish.
Yeah.
It's like super Irish, yeah. Although if you're of a certain generation, you hear Sean Paul and you think I'm a Jamaican rapper, which I'm the whitest person ever, so that's weird. But all of that is to say that alcoholism and mental health too, and addiction, are all over my family. And so I grew up with that knowledge and having that in my direct family tree. And but as a kid, I was super creative. I was always interested in storytelling. I grew up in the 70s and 80s, so I was super inspired by, Jim Henson and Shel Silverstein,
yeah,
and Maurice Sendak. Like, those were like my freaking idols. Like, those were the people who taught me how to like tell stories, and like those are the like goals, you know. And then getting older, like all of the movies from the 70s and 80s and stuff, like, so that was like how I escaped my intense childhood, was watching movies all the time, and that was like my thing, you know, and music too. And so, and that's why, like, my work is all really rich with pop culture shit. Like, it's all in there because it's, that's my roots, and that's what I'm inspired by. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the kind of kid I was. And then I started using drugs and drinking at 14.
14.
Yeah. I was in an accelerated program. Yeah.
Where did that come from?
If you understand anything about trauma, and if you crack trauma open, mm-hmm. I think one of the things that you find is that people like myself with early childhood trauma were something like a 94% higher to develop a problematic relationship with drugs and alcohol than normal people are. And normal people, whatever the hell that is.
Yeah.
But, right? Like, that doesn't exist. But, yeah. Like, yeah. If you are normal, please send Christopher a letter and he can have you as a guest on this show.
I would love to talk to a normal person.
Right? Right? It would be weird. So that was kind of the thing, is like, my childhood was really intense and there was a lot of trauma. And so when I was offered drugs and alcohol, I was like, yeah, because I needed that drink by then. And
yeah.
And being a kid already predisposed to escape, drugs and alcohol provided an escape that was bigger than movies and books and TV.
Yeah.
And I was also kind of an outsider, and drugs and alcohol made me like popular with kids that I thought I wanted to be friends with, who were actually losers, but whatever. But like, you know, like, so it really, it checked a lot of boxes, and I am never going to be one of those people who says, oh, right away, it didn't work for me. I mean, it actually worked for me, you know, it worked for me for a long time. It fulfilled a task, and then it did not. And I had a really long road with it, you know, and I didn't get sober until 36. So my career, and I love when addicts and alcoholics refer to it as a career, it's a very low paying and shitty career, but my career was like 22 years long, and with stints of like, oh my God, I need to stop, or changing the substance so things would like feel more under control, but like it never was. And so my life just got categorically really bad in 2009, and then that was the moment. And at that point, I was able to reach out to family members who were sober, particularly my sister, who had close to 5 years at the time, and get help. And so that's when my story changed. I was in Los Angeles and I got sober there. And yeah. And so that's kind of how we ended up here.
Well, sober in Los Angeles is, I mean, that's a whole other thing. I mean,
oh my God,
I don't know how you could enjoy it there.
Well, I mean, the good thing is, so in LA, there's like something like 30,000 meetings, right?
Yeah.
And so there's just as many like recovery programs as there are bars. And I think in a big city like that, it's very real that people just die from drugs and alcohol there.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like other places where people get sober and they can hang out and it's a small community. It's like the community is large, and the downside of it being large is just people die from it all the time.
Yeah.
And so I think it was a harrowing but helpful thing for me to get sober around, for sure.
Yeah. So what was your, your go-to? Because a lot of people will kind of experiment with a few different things. Like, you know, I've had friends that were addicted to heroin, and they were like, you know what, I'm gonna back off the heroin, and I'm gonna, because the heroin is rough, so I'm just gonna go to meth because meth makes things easier. And,
right.
You know, experimenting with different dosages, trying to find a way to keep yourself in control while not having to let go of your addiction. What was your stuff?
Well, I don't discriminate. I really believe in being addicted to everything. I'm like the Statue of Liberty, but with drugs and alcohol. I'm like, you're all welcome. But I like started with alcohol and weed, and drugs were easier to get as an underage kid.
Yeah.
So like, I did a shit ton of acid and ecstasy, and I did those things like in an amount so much so that they would stop working, you know, and like the desired effect would not exist because I did so much.
Right.
And so then, like, thank God when I turned 21, I was like, oh good, I can just drink. So alcohol was definitely the pervasive thread. But I really, like, I wouldn't say no to anything, and even things I didn't like. You know, I didn't love pills, but if you gave me one, I'd be like, oh, great, thanks.
Yes.
Let me have another. Yeah. I'll take a fistful. And so then, like, but cocaine is a huge part of my story. And cocaine, I started cocaine at 17, and it was a recurring guest star for many, many years.
Yeah.
And almost 20 years. And towards the end, it was booze and cocaine that really brought the house down, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot to go through. I got pretty lucky in that regard.
You did?
In the sense that my experiences with alcohol and cocaine were essentially, man, it is all kind of blurry, but... what I do remember about it is that the two did go hand in hand.
One facilitates the other, right?
Yeah.
Like the more blow you do when you're starting to feel out of control, that's okay. Have a few drinks. Or if you're starting to feel like you're too drunk, that's okay. Have some more cocaine. Or if you want to drink have some more cocaine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. They should sell them in like a combo pack.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. But the thing that, I think the thing that got me out of it was I just kind of, like, I left the situation that all of that was kind of part of. And then it just wasn't really available. So it sort of, it helped that I kind of got myself out of the situation through, I don't know, mental health problems, I guess. Because it sort of forced me to get clean while I was trying to get sane.
Nice.
So that was what got lucky for me. And then I realized that, you know, this isn't sustainable for me. I've got to be really careful with this. Because I've got that addictive personality too. I would find myself excited by situations and just trying to replicate situations, almost obsessive compulsively. I remember I was working at, my girlfriend had got me a job at a tanning salon, And it was awesome. Right upstairs from a hair salon. And the guy that owned the hair salon, his name was Tom. He was fucking hilarious. I loved Tom. And we would hang out, and he would, and because I was underage, he would take me to the gay bar. And we would go, and people would buy me drinks, and then the owner of the bar was this big gregarious dude named Bambi. And Bambi had the Coke.
Bambi.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh my God. Just a visual of a Coke dealer named Bambi is freaking awesome. I love it.
Yeah. Bambi was an interesting fellow. He would wear this, a bathrobe. He would have a giant fishbowl of brandy, and he would just wander around like a rotund Caligula. Just wandering around. He owned the place. It was amazing.
That is amazing.
I fell in with all these people, and I don't know. It was a fun scene for when it was. And weirdly, right. I have kind of a soft spot in my heart for it. But at the same time, it was not good for me at all.
Right. Not a positive environment.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, once I got out of that, and it didn't help that I was kind of rebelling against being bipolar at the time.
Yeah.
So you put those things all together. I got very low and very suicidal, and that is what triggered me into getting myself well, was a suicide attempt. And so it was once I came out of the hospital, it was like, let's calm down a little bit for a while.
Right.
Yeah. And I lost touch with those people. And I mean, in a lot of ways, I guess it's probably best I did. I mean, I would have stayed in touch with Tom. I went back to visit him a couple of times. And then I found out that when I found out he died, I was so sad.
Is sad.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, being a gay man myself and being sort of growing up in that era and going to clubs in the 80s and 90s and doing that whole thing, like, it's not a lifestyle really built for longevity.
Yeah.
However, there are people that stay alive in it and for a really long time, and it's like, oh my God, how the fuck are you doing this?
Yeah.
But
cocaine is a big problem in the clubs.
Oh, yes. Yes, it is. And I work in restaurants too. And so restaurants, the same deal.
Yeah.
Like addiction in general, it like kicks that industry's ass. Like it's so all over that industry, and that industry is littered with people who don't want to grow up and who are really fighting mental health problems and fighting addiction and fighting alcoholism. And so if that's your scene, restaurants are a great place to work, because you really can be with people 12 to 15 hours a day that will completely validate your experience. And not only that, be able to supply you with more of whatever you like. So,
That was my experience with restaurants as well. I mean, it's especially back of the house. It's all fucking pirates.
Oh my God. And it's like a hotbed of like poor mental health.
Yeah. Oh, completely. So what was your first experience with discovering that there was anything off with your mental health? Is that something that was a discussion amongst, while you were growing up? Was your family pretty good about recognizing mental health issues?
No, I mean, again, I grew up in a different era, and so it wasn't really a conversation, right? And my dad was struggling with his own alcoholism, and so it was like, but I definitely, had the signs of PTSD and had the signs of depression from very early on. I also have a very hard Swedish lineage through my family tree, and that lineage definitely, like, if you look at statistics, it's like huge rates of suicide and huge rates of depression.
Yeah.
And so it's like addiction, it was in my genetic makeup. And then like PTSD, I think now we know what we know about trauma, and that all of the things, and even growing up in an alcoholic home, and then being severely bullied and stuff like that. Like, it was just sort of in my genetic makeup pretty young. And so it was never really outright conversation, but I think people knew, teachers and different people knew that, like, I was struggling for a really long time, you know? And so, yeah. So, and like I said, it, like, so thank God for drugs and alcohol, because it really was the best way to treat that stuff.
Right.
Early on, and help me feel level, you know?
Well, and it weirdly kind of gives you a community.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So even though it's not necessarily the most healthy of places to be, you have people and you've right. got each other.
Totally. Absolutely.
So as far as getting yourself over the hump of your own problems, like when was it? Because the thing is, it's a lot easier to ask the question of, you know, when did you discover that you needed help? But I find right. that in a lot of cases, people generally will, it's not really one moment. It's right. it's a long kind of process toward
totally.
Talking to yourself into. So yeah. what was that? What was your process?
I mean, I think I had several, and you're absolutely right. Like, everybody's journey is different. And I do love those stories where it was like one lightning bolt that told somebody, like, oh my yeah. God, you're fucked up. You need to get help. And I mean, right. I wish that was my case, but like, I feel like I had a thousand lightning bolts in like my 20-year journey with all of this that like, were trying to tell me like, oh my God, get help. But I like was so deep in it. I couldn't, but I mean, I definitely like, I had done some therapy. I had quit drinking for stints and realized that things were out of control. I tried meditation. I hopped on any like sort of bandwagon or self-helpy thing just to like in hope of like leveling me out or figuring out what was going on. But like I also was like sick enough that I didn't think it was that bad. Yeah. I had everything under control.
Right.
Yeah, I used to go to this dive bar in Los Angeles, and there was a guy there who was there all the time, and he would like just get shit house drunk, like all like completely, and hang out at the end of the bar, and his name was Henry, and you know, he'd be like falling. Oh, and he had a glass eye too. And like, I remember one time, like his glass eye even fell out, like on the bar, and like really, really shit house drunk. And like,
yeah.
And one of his taglines was like, he's obviously like passing out on the bar, and the bartender or somebody next to him would be like, hey, Henry, are you okay? And one of his taglines is like, everything is going to be okay. And it's like, everything is not okay. Like, you yeah. do not, fundamentally, you do not look okay.
Yeah.
And like, and that's literally how I drank and used drugs, and like also like ignored my mental health. Like, despite like neon signs all over the place, like I was like, nah, it's not that bad. Like I kept getting evicted, and my health was really bad, and I was in like really toxic relationships, and despite all of that, I was like, meh, I've seen worse, you know? And it's like, yeah. no, literally, it's so bad. But I think when you're deep in it, it's really hard, you know? And we have this conversation a lot. I also now, in addition to being a writer and a podcaster and all that stuff, I also work at a hospital here in Portland, Oregon, on an addiction medicine team as a recovery mentor. And one of the conversations we have kind of ongoing about the mental health piece is like, you know, people always say, why didn't that person reach out before they commit suicide, right?
Yeah.
Or before they overdose. And it's like, that's obviously an ignorant statement, because if you've ever been in it, that's something that doesn't occur to you. Right. And it's also something you don't want to do, because you have so much shame and you're in so much pain.
Absolutely.
And I don't know what the alternate message of why don't you, they reach out or just reach out. I don't know what that alternate message is, but that ain't it. Like, that's impossible. That's almost like saying you're doing the wrong thing by not doing something impossible. You yeah. know, that's like telling a baby bird, like, oh, why don't you just fly? It's like, fuck.
Yeah.
I would if I knew how, you
it
know?
Needs and it's to be like, a completely different conversation. It's almost
absolutely.
Like asking someone, you know, why didn't you solve that problem with algebra?
Right.
if so you've never learned algebra? How can you be expected to manage a mental health problem in a well thought out and emotionally intelligent way if you've never been given the tools to do that in the first place?
Exactly. And when we're looking at these things from a disease model and looking at them as real illnesses, and so that, again, it's akin to telling somebody with cancer, like, why don't you just get better? You know, like,
yeah.
Like you can't. And so I think maybe the shift has to be, why didn't the person suffering reach out? Why didn't we reach out?
Yes.
Why didn't we notice that somebody wasn't okay? And why didn't we take 5 seconds to send a text message being like, hey, I'm just thinking about you.
Yeah.
You know? And is that going to save somebody's life? I don't know. But at least it's like you're combating the negative forces that are happening for this individual. And what if they get 1,000 of those a day? And what if they get 100 Facebook messages? I mean, what if it starts to change just because people are like, hey, I give a shit and I just thought you should know.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And what, that's a low to no investment on the half of other people around us and on our communities. You know, if we see people struggling, why don't we fucking say something? Why don't we say, like, hey, you doing okay? You want a cup of coffee? You know, I mean, I don't know. I just feel like it's such an ongoing conversation. And
well, and it's a conversation that has to happen at a societal level. We've got to start changing the way we think about it as a group, in our own groups, in our friend groups, in our family groups, in our neighborhood groups, and it has to grow to a thing where it's just, this is kind of what we're accepting. You know, much like we used to have this idea of what is normal, the idea of what is normal has been progressively changing over the course of, you know, our entire existence as human beings. And this just needs to be a part of that conversation. You know, some people have different color skin. Some people have different colored brains. You know what I mean? It's that kind of thought process that we just need to start learning to wrap our heads around so that we can start talking to people instead of about people.
Exactly. Exactly. And also approaching it from a stigma-free place, right? Instead of like, with all of these old storylines of approaching people with mental health challenges and with substance use disorders as like broken people, we approach them as people who are suffering from an illness like anybody else would, you know, and we want to be able to be helpful instead of like furthering a stigma in conversation, you know? So I don't know. I feel grateful though that like people like yourself and people like me and people all over now have platforms thanks to the magical internet.
Yeah.
That we and social media and all that stuff that we like can continue this and like to take some of the power back and be like, hey, listen, I have this too. It sucks, but it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
And it's only a big deal when we don't talk about these things.
Yeah. You know, I talk to the way I talk to people, and the way I look at it is almost like when I sit down with somebody and we're having a conversation about our various maladies, it's almost like trading recipe cards. You know,
right.
Like
absolutely.
When I have this problem, this is my go-to. Have you ever thought about using cumin? You know, like
right.
You just
exactly.
kind of have conversations about it so that you can find ways to live around and with whatever the thing inside you is that's dragging you back.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And that's part of what I get to do in my professional role at the hospital is really just support people where they are and without an agenda and without trying to swoop in and fix anybody's life. And really nine times out of 10, I just say, oh my God, that sounds really hard. What do you need? How can I help you out?
Yeah.
Instead of being like, you need to do blah, 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 blah. Like, has that ever worked in the history of mental health and addiction of like
no.
people like stockpiling you with a bunch of bullshit advice? It's like, that's not going to help. That's never helped anyone ever, but thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can only speak for myself. I mean, I would prefer to be presented with options versus being told prescriptions.
Right. Absolutely. And also, I would just like support, right?
Yeah.
I would like people just to like show up and like be there when I'm not feeling okay and take me to a meeting or come with me to a doctor's appointment or, you know, like all of those things that are, again, really powerful, but really easy and don't require a bunch of links to internet articles or anything. Like, it's just really like showing up for each other and the power of that, whether that be just on the phone or in person or whatever. But I mean, I think, you know, I think it starts there for sure.
What were the biggest differences for you between the first time you reached out for help and the last time you reached out for help?
Well, and that's an excellent question. And I feel like, you know, the first time was definitely in 2009 and was really like where I started to realize that I had a problem and that I needed to stop. And that was really like asking my sister who was sober and my dad who was sober, and they both still are, and really like starting there and then asking other sober people that I met along the way for help. And then the interesting thing about that is, you know, I feel like I still ask for help. And so like, I really, it'll be almost 2 years ago in December, I really started to look at my PTSD with a therapist here in Portland. I had had an experience of going to Los Angeles and visiting family, and out of nowhere, all of this stuff came up, and it felt really terrible and heavy and bad, and I didn't know what to do with it. And so I went to a therapist, and he was fantastic, and I actually... there's essays about it in my book, and I don't know, you know, there's a saying of like, time plus tragedy equals comedy, you know, like, and a little bit of distance to write on stuff helps. I don't know if there was enough distance in writing about PTSD, and I think I need to write more about it, but I felt like I needed to write about it because being a sober person, you know, there, you hear so much of people who they get sober and then they realize, oh, holy shit, I'm also bipolar. Or I have all these other things going on that I was treating that are now like, hi, we're here. Take care of me. So
the problems that you were pouring your sunshine on.
Exactly. And so, so that time really looked like I knew what to do. And really being willing to look at stuff that was going to be hard. And it was really hard. And, but ultimately got so much strength and personal freedom, that have been gained since that process. And really, and then the beauty of it is being able to talk to other people with PTSD and encourage them to, and be like, oh my God, I get it. And I swear you can get help for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And has your family been pretty supportive in all of this?
They're amazing. They're really amazing. They are super amazing. And we've all done a lot of work on ourselves, you know, and we've all changed a lot. And they're as hilarious and random and crazy as I am, and great too. And, you know, like when my book came out, my dad sent me a text message and said, congratulations, way to capitalize on your family misfortune. And I'm like, yes. Yeah,
hey,
it's awesome.
You know, if you can't, I mean.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, that is so much of what my recovery has been about, is like being able to lean into the truth of my whole life, my entire life. And looking at it and hopefully talking about it, and then maybe somebody getting something else out of it. And if not, at least I've been able to like get a perspective on it and been able to laugh at it. You know, much of my work is comedic, and I think, you know, it's off-putting to some people because they're like, oh my God, that's really fucking dark.
Yeah.
But like, if you've ever been in any sort of recovery meeting or any sort of group therapy situation, you know, people laugh at really fucked up shit.
Yeah.
And we need to heal and to stay alive and to like let the air out of these things that would otherwise kill us, you know? And when we also add humor to those things, we're like, I get to laugh at parts of my life because now I own these things.
Yeah.
And those, you know, one of my personal heroes is Nora Ephron, and Nora Ephron has a great line of, if you slip on a banana peel, that's everybody else's joke. That's the people who saw it around you. That's their joke of you slipping on the banana peel. If you slip on the banana peel and then tell the story of how you slipped on the banana peel, it's your joke. You get to own that joke. And that's really how I feel about me talking about my recovery. And Carrie Fisher's another huge hero of mine too. And same thing is like,
her books are phenomenal.
Oh my God. They're so good. They're so good. I read Wishful Drinking when I had like 90 days sober, and it really changed my life. And so like, so it's really about like being able to take those things that are really unsavory, and I get something out of it every time I talk about it, you know.
Right.
And maybe it's a little bit more freedom, and maybe I'm just a little bit more comfortable, and it looks less scary than it used to. And that's the thing about difficult childhoods or PTSD. You know, it feels so dark and insurmountable. And also there's shame around it. Like, why is this still controlling my life?
Yeah.
And why am I still fucked up over this? And, but looking at it, it really starts to normalize the experience. And I also had a great therapist who told me, look, a lot of this is not going to go away, and that's okay. And you can now be in the room with it and be okay with it when it's in the room with you.
Yeah.
And, huge, 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 huge stuff, but stuff I couldn't have gotten to on my own, right?
Yeah. No, completely. But that's a big step toward being a healthy person, is especially if you're a person who's been through a whole bunch of shit, had a lot of experiences that could be seen as overwhelmingly negative, but you lived
right
through that, and now what do you do with those things now that you're carrying them with you? And
absolutely,
one of your options is to be able to take that and reframe how you feel about that narrative, or at least reframe the way you tell that story so that it now has a different connotation for you. It's a little like Take Back the Night in a certain way. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and that's really the stem of the title of the book, that Now That You've Stopped Dying, is like, it's based on an essay that I did for Medium about like, well, now that you stopped dying, like, now what? Now what are you going to do?
Yeah.
And really, it is about that. It's like, okay, so, you know, there is that slow, and it's interesting that I'm doing this podcast right now, and it's interesting that I've had suicide come up in my personal life with a friend, and then I attended a training at work, and it's very present. And then I was talking about it with somebody else who's also in recovery, that like, you know, when you're on that track of drugs and alcohol, it is the world's slowest suicide in slow motion, right? And it's you're just slowly killing yourself, and you know that. And so once you stop, like, then what are you going to do now? And that is kind of the basis of the book and the basis of the essay that the title comes from, is like, well, now what do we get to do? And it's actually kind of exciting. It's like, well, you get to do all the stuff that you didn't know that you were gonna want to do.
Yeah.
You know, I have a essay in there too about all the things that I forgot to do, and one of them was like take care of my teeth. Like, I didn't take care of my teeth, and like they were like falling out of my face. And so I had that I got to do when I got sober. And there's like, you know, I mean, there's this whole other mental health adventure that happens once you start handling your stuff. And I don't know, it's really cool.
Yeah. But you've got to learn to start finding that excitement in other places.
Totally.
Because it doesn't, that need for a charge, once you make peace with it, you have to recognize how you're going to live with it. So what's been your, I don't know, what's been your new adventure, I guess, now that the rush of putting things in you to manufacture adventure is gone.
Right. Well, I mean, a couple of things. Like, I think, sorry, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, good. Okay, so a couple of things. Like, I think, first of all, I am fundamentally, I still very much have an addict brain, and I can make anything problematic, including like social media or food or relationships with people. Yes. Like, just because drugs and alcohol are gone, don't get it twisted. I can still make things really fucking addictive.
Yeah.
And so like, I recognize that, and I know there are certain things like sugar and caffeine and like those things, like I like my relationship with those things, and I'm not willing to give those up. So, but right. Like, as far as positive stuff, like, I've really been able to travel more. I love music and, really am super into music and listen to music constantly. And now I'm comfortable going to shows, and which is in and of itself, like a huge personal triumph, because music and using were so intertwined for me for decades. And so that's really cool. And then also like being creative, you know, being able to say, hey, I want to make this thing, or, oh, I want to write this thing. Or I have a podcast too, and it's called Queer Mental Condition. And it's a whole like queer sobriety podcast that I co-host with a friend of mine. And like, it was just born out of this idea of like, I want to make that. And so we made it. And now I get to do that, right? Like,
yeah.
I get to like have these things, and it really takes me back to being a kid where I used to draw and write stories and make plays for my stuffed animals and like do all this stuff where it's like, and now as an adult, I get to do that too, where I'm like, ooh, now what do I want to do?
Yeah.
And it's really exciting, you know, 'cause now it's like, I actually have the capacity to finish things. I could never finish anything back yeah. then. And now also have the support too. So yeah, I think that's it. Like being creative, and then I have a huge passion for helping other people like myself. And if that is what I got to do, all day long, then I would be incredibly happy.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it's funny that you frame it that way too, that you're getting a lot of things done, because one of the things that I kind of thought about recently was this idea that, you know, relying too much on drugs and alcohol, one of the ways it gets in the way is a lot like, binge watching television.
Because Oh, yeah.
It may be entertaining, but at the end of the day, you have nothing to show for it. And all it did was stop you from doing anything.
Oh, completely.
Well, I mean, all of this is absolutely amazing. And I'm ordering the book. I can't wait for it to arrive.
Sweet.
And I just really appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Christopher.
Thanks for talking to me. And as a matter of fact, I did get that book. And you know what? It's excellent. If you want to get a copy for yourself, and I know you do, there's a link to the Amazon store in the bio below. Otherwise, just go looking for Now That You've Stopped Dying by Sean Paul Mahoney. It is an excellent read. And if you want some more Sean Paul Mahoney, and I know you do, you can check out his podcast that he co-hosts with Marita De Leon, Queer Mental Condition. That's all for this week, folks. If you want to get some more stuff from me, you can always find out what's going on at coffeeoversuicide.com. You can also go to the Facebook page and become a friend of mine. Don't be shy. I'm here for you. And until next week, don't kill yourselves out there.